Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the May 16, 2021 session, focusing on 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 through 13. Keeping it simple. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Crystal Shepherd.
And I'm David Adams.
I sometimes ask annoying questions to Regina, my wife. She's kind of used to it, so most of the time she just ignores them. But fortunately, the podcast gang doesn't have that option. So, and many times the questions I come up with are purely designed to give me a platform for ranting. So just transparency there. Mm-hmm. The question I have for you today is, what is something that is often made to be more complicated than it should be or has to be?
I have one, and it's figuring out the size pants you wear or jeans for women's clothing. Because in every single brand, it's a different size. Hmm. So you could be a 4 in one size and a 12 in another one. And you don't know until you try to pull them up over your thighs. Hmm. And so then you start like crying in the middle of a dressing room. I do not speak from personal experience, but yeah, it should be simpler. I don't know why it's not.
Absolutely.
Rant over.
Okay. Well, this is a good one, though.
This is an invitation to rants.
It is.
Okay, insurance. Let me give you insurance. Oh, because 2 years ago or so, I had to cancel a health insurance thing with an HSA on it. And I had an account, and I said, hey, close this account. I no longer have this job. I'm not putting any money in. I don't have that insurance anymore. Here it is now, 2 years later, just this week, I'm getting things from them saying, hey, we've changed this in your account. Here's a new credit card based on your account. Here's all this stuff. There's at least 6 times now that I have called them to say, hey, cancel this account. Several emails have been sent to them. The last one was finally met with a response of, here, fill out this form and then call us to tell us you filled out the form and then we'll cancel your account. And the form wants numbers that I haven't known for 3 or 4 years. You have to somehow find those numbers. And if you ask them for the numbers, they won't tell you because those are special numbers. And so I may have this insurance until the day I die, even though I don't have this insurance.
That does sound complicated, David.
Yeah.
I hate your questions, David.
I know you do.
I wish I could ignore them like Regina. Crystal inspired me, and I'm going to show how I'm not like other girls. Pantyhose. Most people have given up on those, and I get it. I understand, but I love a good pair of pantyhose. But here's the thing. They always change them. Always. You find the one that fits perfect and that works perfect, and then you go back later when you get a run in the first ones to buy more, and they've changed them. They've changed the look, they've changed the size, they've changed the color, they've changed the name, and it's impossible. Or they're gone all the way, and you have to start all over again and find a new pair. So I think this is true for lots of things, but it is particularly frustrating in the area of pantyhose for me. Mm. I love a good pair of stockings.
Oh, see, that I was going to use that same example.
I know. You love your stockings, don't you?
I do. No.
I could say the same for razors, but
yeah,
razors are the same.
See, you came up with 2.
I did. Just get me started and I'll just keep going.
So for me, you know, I have quite a list, but I'm going to focus on one. And that is getting gasoline for my car. So there's one of the gas stations that I go to just because it's convenient is it likes to have me fill out a triplicate form, a full survey in order to get gasoline. So, you know, you put your card in and he says, do you want to use credit or debit? Okay, fine. I do that. Would you like a car wash with your gas today? No, I just want gas. Would you like to have the fuel additive so-and-so plus supreme added to your? No, I just want to get gas. Would you like to use your Kroger fuel points on this? You know, and it goes on and on. And by the time I'm done, I don't even care anymore. Why can't I just drive up, get gas, and drive off? That's all I want to do.
So are we in the time of designer gas now? Mm-hmm. Yes. Like, can you have designer gas now?
I have designer gas, yes. Oh, my gosh. That's a great phrase, Nikki.
I mean, that's what it – what additives did you have put in your gas? my additives make me cooler.
You're talking about petroleum, right?
Yes.
Just asking.
Oh, well, there's so much that is more complicated than it needs to be. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's accidental. And sometimes we just like to make things complicated. So with that in mind, we're going to continue in our study in 1 John. And David, would you help us get started?
Sure. Long ago, I was a biblical backgrounds nerd. I studied all the New Testament information and was particularly fascinated by patristics, which was the study of early Christians who produced much of our Bible. It was something I really wanted to know a lot about. But one day, I was confronted by a weird little man who asked me if I considered doing doctoral work in education. As many of us might do when approached in public by someone who is obviously mentally unhinged, I quickly agreed to do as he asked. And so soon I found myself engaged in earning a degree in one of the least valuable things anyone could learn, especially if they want to be involved in seminary education. I mean, who wants to have people hanging around the school teaching courses on how to run a church and how to work with people of different age groups and how to use technology or other practical things? It's just crazy. For my sins, I was sentenced to serve for many years as that lowest form of life on a lot of church staffs, a youth minister. I used to regale my youth with stories of all the practical jokes I played over the years. And then I recommend that to everyone who deals with teenagers. It's not that you give them ideas, but as some of my youth told me years later, they were so terrified at what I might do in retaliation that they didn't want to prank me. Nonetheless, they once got me really good. My first office was about the size of the closet in my bedroom, where you could barely fit three people if you tried. I came back from my Christmas vacation one time to find a large operational tree, lights, ornaments, and all, filling the space. It was so huge I couldn't even get around it to my desk, so I had no idea how they accomplished this. But I appreciated the teamwork and dedication it took to get in there. It had to be cut apart to get it out. It was that large. So if you have a group and you'd like to try your hand at team practical joking, I recommend that you start slowly. Go to a crowded public place and look up. Maybe some of you can try pointing and occasionally saying things like, "Is that a bird?" or "I think it's a UFO." Of course, the best thing to say is, "Wow, Larry Norman was right," in reference to his song, Nightmare Number 97. Not many people will get that joke, but every time someone says this, Burt Montgomery gets his wings, so it makes it worth doing. When you deal with teenagers, you have to understand that as much as we might talk about the groups we run with, we are all identified by how we behave, both collectively and individually. Great practical jokes are the good part of this. They show community and a sort of love and trust that might not otherwise be there. On the downside, when groups fail to do right, you have to gather them and share in that experience too. I can't count the number of times I had to call a batch of young people together and say something like, "Tomorrow morning when people come in and see this place as a wreck, they're not going to say that Will Martin messed it up. They're going to say that the youth group left the mess. We're all judged by the behavior of the group, so if you're not willing to solve this problem together and clean things up, it's not going to matter whose fault it was. The blame falls on all of you." Now that we're coming to the end of 1 John, we should probably remember how we got here. John's church was facing a number of divisive issues, but perhaps none that was as difficult as trying to answer people who were trying to break the church by leading it into an emerging Gnosticism. While there are various theories around what exactly John was dealing with, as you saw from the rest of this general letter, John was really concerned with keeping people focused on the centrality of love to Jesus' teaching, as shown in the way they treat others and by the kind of people they choose to follow. John is laying things out for them like a youth minister with a group that is going astray. And here at the end of the letter, John is laying out some final thoughts in hopes of summarizing his arguments. Depending on how you interpret them, he's saying that there are three theological arguments that testify to Jesus and his ministry: the Spirit, the water, and the blood. We're not totally clear on what this means, but we often take it to mean that some of the events in Jesus' life, especially his baptism and crucifixion, happen as a show of proof that he is who John says he is. A number of Bible scholars believe this to be a more precise focus on the various theories put out by his opponents, at least one of whom may have been teaching that the Spirit came to Jesus at baptism and left at crucifixion, since God couldn't possibly be rejected and killed by humans. Others suggest that this statement makes a case for a more human Jesus, who had spirit, was born as a normal baby, water breaking and all, and died. Whatever the case, John wants his people to know that God's testimony is superior to human testimony. God's testimony is written on your heart, if you come to depend on Jesus. And if you don't accept that, which is demonstrated by how you treat God's other children, you make God out to be a liar. In a way, John seems to be saying, if you don't buy what I've been telling you about having God in your heart, you're not really alive. It's easy to get drawn deeply into parsing out every word of this short passage and trying to make out exactly who John was talking to and what all this means on a deep theological basis. But John likely didn't see it that way. It seems like John is trying to make it as simple as possible. But he gets tripped up on words at the end and summarizes it all by pointing out that God should be written on our hearts. And if God is, we're all right. Maybe that's enough. After all, people have been and will be forever arguing over the implications of all those things Jesus said or did. John even tells us that at the end of his gospel. We can argue and fight about every theological point. And the best part about that is that we're probably all wrong. None of us were there, after all. We're really just looking back over our shoulders as we try to go forward in faith. All of this serves to bring me back to where I began this story today. There are people who want a more complicated faith. They want to be able to talk about all the cool little theological points where they and others might agree or argue. There's great energy devoted to having so-called correct beliefs and gathering up all the correct evidence to support those beliefs. We've had centuries of people playing this game, and it has both led us in circles and into conflict with each other. By this point, the game has gotten tedious, and as we watch people leave their faith behind because we've overcomplicated it, overinterpreted it, or just plain pretended to own it, in ways that leave other people out, we're left to wonder why people don't want to follow our path anymore. John says that those of us who have their faith written in their hearts have all we need. If our worldview is built upon the Jesus we find through loving other people, we have done all we need to do. Why do we have to make this so hard?
Thanks for that, Dave. I both got a good laugh and and also provoked some good thoughts. One of the things that I couldn't help but think about was the HOA meeting that we had in our community just a few nights ago. So I live in a townhome community, and we're all up together, right? I mean, that's part of being in a townhome community. You're neighbors and you're close, and there are some things that seem to be simple. Okay, I left the meeting after an hour, and they were still going. And the topic of the night was parking. Ooh. So we had gone from, so the townhome community is only like 3 or 4 years old. It's not that old, really. So we had gone from just, you know, be nice to each other, park, and be, you know, be decent human beings, to suddenly there was a 5-page manual that showed the proper and improper ways that you could park in your own driveway, where guests were to park, if you had service vendors that were coming to work on your house, that here's how they need to park and what you need to do. And I was like, whoa, that's a lot. So of course, I took I took the diagram that showed the proper ways to park downstairs to Regina to explain it all to her.
I bet she loved that.
No, she didn't like it at all. Not that she doesn't park well. She really does. But I thought it would be a lot of fun to try to regurgitate all that. But seriously, I mean, it's like humans. It's like we just have to do this, right? We have to make things so complicated.
I think we complicate things because we want to control them.
Mm. No, I think I was getting at that toward the end of what I was talking about. This idea that we want to own it. It's ours. And we'll add all the complications we need to make sure we can continue to own it.
That's right. Nobody else can do it.
You can park in your own driveway, but not in your garage, as long as you can see a little bit of driveway behind your back wheel.
Mm. And I know this is kind of strange, but by now you think I'm kind of strange anyway, but I once preached on this passage to my church. Everything goes back to a church preaching story. I once preached on this passage to my church, and to fully introduce it, I had our church drummer. We have a drummer who's really good. I had him get behind me and drop me a beat. And as he played the beat, I read the disclaimer for a Major League Baseball game. You know, all the things you can do. And then I started reading the instructions off of a tube of ointment that you put on your arm if you had a rash or something like that. And I pointed out that this is the rhythm of our faith. We feel comfortable when we make it that complicated. When it sounds like they have something to say, our many words given a sort of authority that it wouldn't have if we just made it easy.
Like give something more weight the more we've parsed it out or broken it down or explained it.
It's one of those golden techniques on the internet. If you ever like to get in these discussion groups and talk back, I know none of you would ever do that, but if you ever did get on a discussion group and talk back to people, inevitably there is someone who will want to write 14 paragraphs of nonsense to prove their point. Mm-hmm. You know, with the idea that the more I can say, the more authority I have to be making this point. Therefore, you have to believe what I said. It seems to be a common thing that people do now. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've already taken the name of Burt Montgomery in vain. So in that sense, a song comes to mind, actually, as we talk about this. It seems to fit this very well. It's a song by The Police. Do-do-do. Remember that one? The whole point of the song is people have words to protect their position, to control things, and they can control the conversation. They control us by that. Mm-hmm. There's this great line like, poets, priests, and politicians have words that establish their position. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that go on with us. And we will take John now, because by now we're at the end of John's letter. And John didn't try to make it too complex. But you can tell he's speaking to the audience that wants it to be a little more because, after all, they're sounding so educated with all their new theologies and things. And it looks like he almost runs out of words and starts repeating himself. If you remember last week, there's a lot of the words in here that pretty much follow where we went last week, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When really all John wants to do is say, look, just love everybody and walk off. He's trying to find a way to close his letter to do that because he knows people take you more seriously when you use words like that. And we do that. I think we have to do that. You know, there are many things that we do in our faith that make it harder. And when we make it harder, we lose people.
And I think the harder we make it sometimes takes us further away from it too. So, you know, if it really boils down to what John is saying is that we need to love other people. And then we like start piling all these rules and these hoops that people have to jump through just to participate in our faith, then it's making it harder. It's making it inaccessible. Sometimes I wish that we could just kind of like just cut all the crap, for lack of a better word, and just get to the heart of it and just say, this is what we need to be doing. I mean, Jesus does it. He's like, hey, look, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Like, not hard. I mean, it's hard, but it's not hard, right? Like, and John's saying the same thing. John's just reiterating it, and no one is listening.
Yeah, but who is my neighbor after all?
Yeah, there's always someone who wants to put more on it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh.
And so that's how we get the parable of the Good Samaritan, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Jesus was very patient, don't you think?
Until he flipped tables.
Okay, okay. All right, who is my neighbor? Well, let me tell you a story. Do you get it now?
But if you want to go deeper into some of the stuff John says, the way he uses dualisms and things, and we all got this in the exegesis class. If you pour all this oil on the water, so to speak, you know, if you put all this cover on there, it's a lot easier to slip in and dehumanize people and not have a true faith, because after all, it's buried under so much stuff. Who's going to see? Mm-hmm. Who's going to know? Mm-hmm. So our words become something that hides the darkness that we don't want people to see. Mm-hmm. This is why John's always making it easy.
It makes me think of that parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector praying in the temple. You've got the Pharisee who is praying about how good he is and how he's not like other people. But then you have the tax collector whose prayer is held up in the parable as the model. And he says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Mm-hmm. And that is his simple prayer. I think that when we overcomplicate it the way that we're talking about here, we not only make it inaccessible to other people, we make it inaccessible to ourselves. We make it so complicated that we spend all of our energy understanding it with our brain, but not embodying it with our spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think if it boils down to love, something that I see is that we can't possibly accept this love because we don't love ourselves. And I see it all mm-hmm. the time in the counseling office. How can God love me when I don't love myself? And then when I don't love myself, how can I love others? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the biggest complication of all.
Yes, but we want to put a blanket over that and cover it so we don't have to confront that directly.
Mm-hmm. Because we're so busy comparing and we're so busy trying to put up those walls because we can't let people see that, because then we're vulnerable.
If you look at the background of this passage, of the entire Gospel of John, and what was, okay, I admit it, being a church, a biblical backgrounds geek, I had to go back and look at all this and see what the early church fathers had to say about it. They were men, that's why I call them church fathers. They wouldn't let women write back then. You know, get away from that pen. but they were, stop that, drop that pen, woman. But they were talking about some very specific things that were being done by an emerging Gnostic at this time. And this whole idea that took away from the humanity of Jesus and said, we can't really be God. He's got to be somebody who was possessed for a short period of time. And then that spirit left him and he was okay again. Then we can go ahead and kill him. They really have a story they had to spin to sell this. You know, that's a lot of weird brain twisting to get people to accept their opinion of things. And in fact, the biblical scholars of the day used to refer to them as the progressives. They're progressives because they weren't comfortable with the story they were told. They wanted to take it and expand on it and to make it go in new directions that would make people think differently. And that was supposedly a bad thing when you do this. So here's John looking at this and he's just got done telling everybody, hey, this is just so easy. But before he goes, he's still got to answer to these folks because he knows as soon as they get this letter, this other person is going to come right back and say, well, yeah, but, you know, John doesn't tell you the whole story here. He's making it too simple. And I think there's a real tension there, though, between trying to control, and so you add words to increase your level of control, and to permit. You know, a lot of the things we've been saying about John for the past few weeks have all been places where John is not requiring us to memorize something or to accept some big theological concept or to do other major things we ask people to do. It's always just been love somebody. Understand that we're all children of God. If you love the father, if you love the parent, then love the child. All these very, very simple things. And so now going out the door, he's still got to say something complicated because he just knows that this person behind him is going to make it bad. You know, and to try to add more complication to it.
So I just, like, for me, I just have to question, like, what does this mean now? Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think I have an answer. I mean, we're if our institution of church is built on this complication, how do we change? I don't know. Like, that's, anybody got any ideas? Because I'm sitting here kind of trying to wrap my brain of going, well, we've got this machine that's been put in place that over centuries has just been like this. I tell clients that we talk about the snowball, and like, you want your snowball to be clean, right? You're rolling up a snowball. You do not want to get down to the dirt and the sticks and the mud, because then there's who knows what in your snowball. And so I talk about like problem snowballing in that way. We don't want all that junk in there. But I think the church has been this snowball that has just rolled and rolled and rolled. And so it's like a machine of its own. And I don't know. I mean, can we just start saying, be a child of God, love others, and that work? I mean,
I'm paying attention to myself in this conversation, and it's interesting. I'm feeling anxious. And I think it's because, Dave, your background and what we're talking about here, it's very real. It's a challenge that we face in the church right now. It's the reason that people who say they walk with the same faith are at odds with one another in internet chat rooms. It's the reason that we are all so very at odds with one another, and how I can talk to a person of Christian faith and we can have completely different understandings of the very same concept because we have over-theologized and over-explained and over-dissected, I think, this gospel message so that it is no longer available to the mass, to the whole, to all people. And you have to fit in this perfect little niche. And I think that I feel anxious because of what Crystal just asked. I don't know how we stop that snowball from rolling. I don't know. I don't know where it ultimately crashes and what it damages in the process. So I took your metaphor and I went a little further with it. And I don't know if that exactly works, but it is concerning. But I think that the word of hope is if we can learn to be okay with more simple, then we can figure it out. We just have to learn to let go, I think, of some things.
So my dad, he loved to do woodworking as a hobby. And sometimes he would build new pieces. Other times he would take pieces that were older. And you know how a finish gets gunked up? And maybe something has been refinished multiple times or somebody's just waxed it, you know, and it's just got layers. And he would always, it was always fun to watch as he stripped away all the old finishings and waxes and got down to the wood. And you could see the beauty of the grain and the color. And then he would revarnish it or finish it in some way. And it was a beautiful piece of furniture again. And maybe that's part of the process that we're struggling with as we talk about our own congregations. And for me, it's not about we used to be perfect back then and we've just got to strip away all this stuff and get back to it. But it's that what is at the heart of what our call is to both as Christians and as congregations. If you boil it all down, what are we called to do and to be? And that focus on mission, that focus on the center of our calling, maybe that draws us to whatever is next, whatever the new shape is going to be. And of course, I'm an old guy, so I'm also, frankly, very heartened that it's not going to be my generation that decides and creates this next work. I certainly believe the Spirit's still working with old folks like me, but I'm also really aware that a lot of times the newness comes as the Spirit works in minds and in hearts that are fresh and eager for something new to be created. And as I like to remind myself as well, that we are weary. We are all so weary. We're weary of the pandemic. We're weary of being on Zoom. We're weary of just being in this moment. God is not weary. And that is something to take heart in. So I want to close this out with the most obvious hymn that has to be read, which is Simple Gifts. It's a Shaker hymn that is so beautiful. And, you know, this was a religious sect in early American history that was so focused on simplicity. Their furniture even expresses it. If you look at how clean the lines are and how the form and the function are just so pure. So I just want to read for you this traditional Shaker hymn and let that perhaps be something we can sit with as we go about our day. 'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right. We won't solve this problem today, but may we all work on it with a God who is nowhere near as weary as we are.
Amen.
And thank you all for this good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about our Faith Element Bible study curriculum at faithelement.net. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.